Inside Speedway is brought to you by P1 Australia and by Speedway Classics Magazine, on sale now. From the dirt tracks across Australia, welcome to Inside Speedway with Dennis Newland and Craig Revell.
Yes, thanks for joining us for another week as we get set for Speedway Classics to be out in news agencies very soon. And then we'll be welcoming back, hopefully not too far away, for Dennis Newland. He can tell you all about what's in the new magazine. We're looking at Speedway first up, and in the Extra Liga, Lesno have made it. They're the first through to the finals of the Extra Liga, which then leaves Sparta and, Stella Grosso as the final two to look for a spot. So hopefully for Max Frick and Ty Wolfenden and the team, Sparta can do well. But Lesno, the first team into the playoffs in the Extra Liga. So in the World Championships, of course, the Speedway World Championships, they're off to Turin for two nights to conclude the season. So it's going to be interesting to see how the Speedway year is wrapped up. We've had some fantastic results so far in 2020 in this very, very compressed and compacted season. And as we mentioned a few weeks ago, the Marquetta Stadium was fantastic. But Bartosz Smarzlik has consolidated his position at the top of the World Championship. Ty Wolfenden and Jason Doyle getting podiums is a great result as well for, well, the Australian and English rider. But we look forward to seeing how the championship wraps up at Turin, and hopefully we can bring you an interview with the world champion in the coming weeks. Now, Valvoline Raceway have announced this week that whilst restrictions are easing, they expect racing would not commence until restrictions are reduced, which is estimating won't be until January 2021. So we look forward to Valvoline Raceway getting back up and running, and hopefully it can be, well, soon into January. So the management there at Valvoline Raceway, just updating the fans. But one thing that NASCAR did this week, which was very interesting, is they announced that the Cup cars will be headed to Bristol and it will be on dirt. So I know a lot of people have been wondering what would it be like to see these modern cars on the dirt. And we're going to get a chance to find out next year as NASCAR have released a very ambitious, calendar for 2021. For the record, NASCAR on dirt, the most successful driver is Lee Petty with 42 wins. Buck Baker with 40, along with Herb Thomas. Thomas Flock has 36. Ned Jarrett has 33 wins. The King is sixth in that tally with 30 wins on the dirt. It's going to be great to see what Bristol will come up with when they start their engines on the dirt once more. Here's some of the announcement that Bristol was able to make.
We are thrilled to have everyone here with us today. As you guys know, Bristol Motor Speedway has hosted many historic events over the years. And we will be adding to that resume in our 60th anniversary year in 2021. Bristol Motor Speedway will transform into a state-of-the-art dirt racing facility for the Food City NASCAR Cup Series race on March the 28th, 2021. The event will mark the first time in the modern era that NASCAR's Cup Series has competed on dirt. The last time the Cup Series competed on dirt was in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1970, and that race was won by Richard Petty. It will be the third time, however, that Bristol Motor Speedway has crossed over to a dirt facility. As the track converted to host World of Outlaw races in 2000 and 2001. And the team here at Bristol Motor Speedway has proven in the past that we know how to transform Bristol Motor Speedway into one of the most pristine facilities anywhere around. So we can't wait to see how the stars of the NASCAR Cup Series take to the dirt in the world's fastest dirt half mile.
To our guest this week, and I'm really looking forward to speaking to this man, it is Stuart Telfer. Now, some of you might know who Stuart Telfer is, but he has been in and around motorsport for many, many years. He has been the manager at Parramatta City Raceway. For the last 17 years, he's been the manager of the Variety Bash. We'll find out about that, his time in America, and, well, a few of the big names in Australian Speedway that he had the chance to meet along the way. It's great to have Stuart Telfer on the show, and I hope you enjoy this chat we had with him.
Inside Speedway is available on sportsradio.com.au, iTunes, Spotify, and thedirttrackchannel.com.
Well, joining us on Inside Speedway today is a man that, well, I've known him for years, and it's probably the tallest man I can remember meeting as a young kid. Stuart Telfer joining us. So, well, when did you first get involved in motorsport? Because you talk to a lot of people like myself. Well, we were dragged there from the moment we were on the earth. But if you don't come from a racing family, what got you to the racetrack the first time?
Well, hello, Craig, and hello to your listeners. Good question. I guess a mate and I from high school started going to Westmead Speedway on a Sunday afternoon on and off. We didn't go every week. We just would catch the train from Dundas Station down the Clyde out to Westmead and walk across, and that was how we got there and how we got home. And, so that's how I started going to the Speedway as a school kid way back when.
Then when did it become more than just a thing to do on Sunday afternoon? When did you get roped into it being more than just something to do?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I would put it down to I lived in Rydalmere, and at the bottom of our street was a service station that had closed down while they built the overhead railway line at Rydalmere, the overhead road. And when it opened up again, I went down, saw the owner, and tried to get a job, after school. And he was kind of an old bloke, and he had me handing out brochures in the letterboxes. And then one day I went down to get my brochures, and there was another bloke there working on the weekend with lawnmowers. A bloke called Sid Hopping had moved in, and without going too much into it, he not long after took over the lease of the garage, and I got a job there on Saturdays, washing car windows, washing shop windows, and for $2 so a day. And I thought I was king, and he had this car that he modified that he'd bought from Clive Sevenoaks, and then one day I go down there, and he's got this beast of a thing that he'd bought from Blair Shepherd. It was Marshall Sargent's car, and I'd never seen tyres as big as. Today they're almost like a front inside front on a spring car, but in those days they were massive big things, well, compared to a road car or a super modified in those early days. And I was hooked, and I joined the crew. I was allowed to join the crew. I got my white overalls with Hopping's mobile service station on the back, and away we went. And I'm not a mechanical person, never have been, Craig. And my top job was to paint in gold leaf Goodyear and Firestone on the tyres and help wash it during the week. That was about my sum total involvement.
Tyres pop up a few times in your story too, I might add. But what was it about white overalls in the 60s and in Speedway? Could there be a worse colour for a mechanic to wear?
You're probably right there. But I guess it was the start of crew uniforms. And I can remember having our photo taken on the infield at Westmead, and how good we looked in our white overalls. Sid was in his silver suit that had been given to him by Jim Fife, who was had Pan Pacific Speed equipment. And it was, you know, like revolutionary. It was a drag racing suit. It was this silvery suit. It wasn't a, you know, a nice henchman or anything like that. And there was three of us in our white overalls, and I was a bit of the organizer. It was even early days, I liked to organize things, and I was organizing the photo, and I wanted the engine to be, which was exposed, just had a piece of, you know, metal over the top sort of thing. And but you could see the right through it and see the motor. And just as they were about to take the photo, one of Sid's helpers, a guy called Sid Arges, great bloke, beautiful bloke, he jumped in. I better jump in this. And I thought, no, you haven't got white overalls. Oh, no, you sat in front of the motor. So that was my big disappointment of that photo. But I've still got the photo. He's great.
You
the white overalls, that was the go in those days. And I was sort of on and off. I was there most weekends. And in Mother's Day 1965, I wasn't allowed to go because it was Mother's Day. And unfortunately, that was the day Jeff Freeman was killed. And from that weekend, I never missed another Speedway meeting basically in my life. Up until the last couple of years, I was there every weekend, sometimes two times a weekend. Whatever.
Mm. Now, 1965, you're still in high school and you're pick crewing for Sid Hopping. You finally get to the Sydney Royale.
Yeah. One of the pick crew guys, Mick Dalton, he was a mechanic at Sid's garage. He said, "You want to go to the showground?" Well, I had to almost, you know, like get royal permission from mum and dad to go out on a Saturday night with a mechanic. In an FJ Ute all the way to the Sydney Showground. We went, and I just I was awestruck. There I got to see these two blokes walk out onto the track with cars pushed out, and there were two Americans, Bob Tattersall and Sherman Cleveland. That was my first night at the Sydney Showground, 1966, and it was the opening of their season, the Yanks season, and I didn't understand it all. And I just remember they had an interview. I loved the accent, and then Tattersall got in his car and they pushed him off and he just bubbled around, boob, boob, boob sort of stuff and for a lap and then stood on it. And I've gone, I'm going to go to this meeting, this racetrack for the rest of my life. That was just the most amazing sound that I'd ever heard. So that was my introduction to Bob Tattersall and Sherman Cleveland. Mm.
How different was the showground for you on a Saturday night under lights compared to Westmead on a Sunday afternoon? Is it chalk and cheese, the experience?
Oh, well, of course it is. Westmead sometimes was dusty and it was a big, big track. It was a bit, you know, the half-mile track was bigger than the showground track, but the showground was obviously big as well, but a lot narrower. But the lights, the ribbon of light around the track and over the cars and all the chrome shining and the noise reverberating off all the grandstands. It was just something different, just something else.
You'd get into a crash crew. Pick crew to crash crews, not a common transition, I would have thought.
What basically happened there is Sid's garage was a melting pot for people. People came from all over the place. Others, speed car crews, the Ray Oram crew used to come and we'd Friday nights when it was, you know, only racing on the weekend or Saturdays and stuff, you know, we went to Parramatta Bowl and we went bowling with Sid and the Oram crew and other blokes. You know, we had all these different people coming to see the Beast let me give it its name, the Beast. I remember how quite clearly there's people sometimes give credit for somebody else calling it the Beast, but Sid asked me, could I help go with him one day? He was had to take the car to Parramatta for a show at Coles. It was going in the Coles. They had not supermarkets in those days. They were sort of like a David Jones and a Myers and all that sort of stuff. They had everything. And it was going in the Coles for a week on show, and and it'd been painted brown and had all the signage on it and everything like that. And we unloaded off a rickety old trailer in the side street and pushed it in the shop. And the manager got the ticket writer. In those days, shops had what they called ticket writers to write signs for, you know, special on this and special on that. And he got her to come over and write a ticket to say, this is Sid Hopping's super modified races at, you know, Westmeath, stuff like that, and what sort of a car it was. And she goes, what a beast. And that's how it got its name right there. And they said, that's a fabulous name. So they wrote the Beast on the, she wrote the Beast in yellow paint on the cowling of the radiator. And that's how it got its name. Mm. But so there's all these people used to come to the garage, and Bob Blacklaw was one. He was there quite often. He raced go-karts, and there was a guy that leased a section off the garage off Sid at the back. He was an upholsterer, and he raced go-karts. And so we got to know people, and, you know, they would take me to the speedway, and Bob was got on the crash crew, and they used his ute as the ute running around the track sort of thing. And then the vacancy came, and bingo, do you want to go? And there I was. That's how I got on the crash crew, which was a great experience. I had a great time on the crash crew. We made a lot of friends, and, you know, just a great time, camaraderie. And there'd be the races, and then there'd be, you know, the barbecues out in Driver Avenue afterwards, and just story after story. Not enough time to go into all those stories, Craig.
And probably some of the people that's still alive, so you can't actually tell them.
Yeah, there's a moratorium on stories.
Yeah, that's right. Now, interestingly enough, I was always told about how Stu Telfer worked for Goodyear. He was over in Akron. He had this amazing American experience. And it seems like someone in my family might have been gilding the lily.
I wonder if that was your dad.
Or was it gilding the tyres, which you said you were doing earlier?
Well, there is a tyre story. In 1973, I went to America with 96 of my closest mates for the 1973 Indianapolis 500. And one of those guys was Barry Blacklaw, who was Bob Blacklaw's uncle, younger than Bob, though. It's a funny story. We were great mates and crash crew guys together. And so off to America we go on the Bill Evans tour, and it was just fantastic, just excellent it was. And we had such a good time, we decided not to come home. So we forfeited our tickets and stayed there. And you got into, you know, we started going to West Capital Speedway, and we loved that, so we'll go on there every week. But I wanted to do more. You heard about all these different stories of the Indy cars and the crews, and they're always looking for workers. So I got on a Greyhound bus, and it took me 3.5 days to get back to Indianapolis. And I went to a motel that I'd stayed at with the tour, which was next to a bar called the Grapesteak Bar or something like that. And the guy in the bar remembered us because we had such a great time. And he said, what are you doing back here? And I said, well, I've come to try and get a job. He said, but it's the end of the season. I said, yep, I know that, but I want to get in early. I don't want somebody say, you should have been here yesterday. Yeah, we had a job you could have had. So he rings up a mate of his. I remember his name. His name's Charlie Prophet. And he turns up. He came out to the bar and said, what's all this about? And I told him, and he says, we're doing a tyre test right now down at Indy, you know, like this is the Indy track. So he said, jump in, off we go down the track, and you know, there's all these top drivers tire testing. And I just couldn't believe it. Long story short, he says, we got a job. We're always looking for tire fitters because nobody wants to travel away from home and stuff. I said, mate, I'm away from home. I'm ready to travel. So he said, in January, we'll get you down to California, California 500 was one of the early races in the year, and went down there in January to do a tire test, and I just I had 2 weeks of the best time with the AJ Foyt, Gary Bettenhausen, Rutherford, Vukovic, you know, Unser. Anybody that drove was top shelf driver for Goodyear was there to tyre test, and I had an amazing experience. AJ turned 40, and he was just—he's one of the boys. He's just one of the boys, and for his 40th birthday, we were in his room playing cards on his bed, and I'll just never forget it. It was, like here's this nobody from Australia playing cards with AJ Foyt. I let him win.
Of course you did. But over the 18 months, so what, you were, what, travelling with Goodyear?
Oh, well, yeah, sorry. Unfortunately, you have to have a green card, and they tried to get a green card for me, but it was got knocked back. So I got paid for 2 weeks, made a bundle of money and compared to what I was used to, and had to go back to Sacramento. And, of course, you're not allowed to work in America without a green card. So
some of us might know different.
but anyhow, I caught up with your dad. I flew back for the 74 Indy 500 and catch up with the tour guys coming back again, and we had a great week and for Indy. And then after the race, your father, George Tatnall, and Gus McClure's mechanic, they were staying to do some other bits and pieces, and they said I could hang with them for a few days, and we travelled around and went to some other races, different places, and got the stories galore. You go on for hours, the little side stories, but they're only boring ones, really.
Yeah, fair enough. But you weren't a mechanic, and you weren't mechanically minded from what you've said, or I'm paraphrasing. No. You've gone through high school. Did you go on, because we're going to talk about you getting into sales and getting into those sorts of things, managing. Did you have any formal training in that type of work, or is everything you've learned on the fly?
A bit of everything there. I left school and became an apprentice. I was an apprentice printer at the government printing office in Sydney and for 4 and a bit years. But I was a hand and machine compositor. I won't bore you with what that does, but it was a dying trade, and Barry Blacklaw did exactly the same thing. He was the same. And our biggest customer ever was Gary Rush. We did his receipt books and business cards and invoice sheets for his workshop at Auburn. And he gave me $5 off a wheel alignment one day. I think he was our biggest customer we had. So our mutual job didn't work. Anyhow, we went, like I said, we went to America. I